This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, March 15th. This is the Week in Review program, and I'm your host, Philip Nice, with our Philadelphia trumpet writers Jeremiah Jacques, Mihailo Zekic, Richard Palmer, and Andrew Miller. And we're going to cover the four sections of the globe that we divide world events into, and we want you to be up to date with what's happened this week and why it's significant, what the larger context is, and how it relates to something called Bible prophecy. The first region is the Middle East. Mihailo Zekic, you watched the Middle East throughout the week. Give us a rundown of the main stories from that region.
On Sunday, March 10th, Libya's three different rival factions came together and announced they are going to try and form a unity government to try and solve Libya's political crisis. They've been in political paralysis, at least for a few years with the current crisis, but really even going through the civil war when Muammar Gaddafi was ousted about 10 years ago. Or over 10 years ago now. But we'll see if that bears any fruit and what that means for North Africa in the future. Moving into the war on Gaza, which a lot of people are watching, the United States intelligence community released its annual threat assessment this week, where aside from the usuals like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Russia, they made a reference to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and how his government and his coalition may be in jeopardy because of, quote, distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule in among the Israeli populace, and that they say that a different, more moderate government, their words, is a possibility. They're not saying that Netanyahu's on the same level as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but the fact that he's included in this particular language, is, many interpret it, rightly so, I'd say, as the U.S. government trying to externally pressure Netanyahu to start playing their tunes, start doing what Washington wants them to do. A bit of a veiled threat. And the Jerusalem Post this week quoted an anonymous senior Israeli political official, quote, "We expect our friends to act to overthrow the terror regime of Hamas and not the elected government in Israel," end quote. Some might see this as just a snide comment, but the kind of pressure in the report is pretty unprecedented. So, and we're going to talk about that a little bit in the main story. So we'll continue to watch how the Biden administration prods at Israel and how Israel responds.
Right. This relationship between the United States and Israel is something that's been really a curious feature of modern history. If you look at the close relationship that these two nations have had for a long time, we often refer to them as brother nations for a very specific reason. But with Israel being as vulnerable as it is to all of its neighbors in that region, it has relied heavily on the United States. And so the relationship between the two is crucial to Israel, and we're seeing something really troubling developing in that relationship.
Yes. So with that annual threat assessment report and the anonymous Israeli government officials' comment, I was debating whether or not to make that my main story. Part of me felt like if I just latch onto the comment too much, the naysayer could say, well, you know, maybe that's just talk, that kind of thing. They're not really trying to overthrow Benjamin Netanyahu, are they? Well, then this guy spoke yesterday.
As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. Israel is a democracy. 5 months into this conflict, it is clear that Israelis need to take stock of the situation and ask, must we change course? At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel.
That was U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking in the Senate chamber about his vision for the Middle East. That was obviously a couple of snippets from a much larger speech, about 40 minutes. He spoke also about Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, etc. But in that speech, he labeled four causes for why we don't have peace in the Middle East today: Hamas, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, extreme views of Israelis, and he was mainly referring to two particular Israeli cabinet members that we'll talk about, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of the Jewish state, the leader of the country that was attacked, that is defending itself. He, according to the highest ranking Democrat in the United States Congress, is the reason we don't have peace in the Middle East. I might have to control myself a little bit in this section, but it is extremely aggravating. Never mind the fact that he's pointing the blame at Netanyahu. Never mind the fact that Netanyahu is winning the war. The war is almost done. It's just Rafah. And once Israel goes in there, Hamas, as far as controlling Gaza, is finished. And people are acting as if that this is going to be like a 2-year-long Ukraine war with a stalemate. It's almost done. The peace is almost there. Never mind that. But he's even calling for Israel to have early elections. I've never heard any high-ranking U.S. politician. Can you imagine them saying something like that for Canada or for any country in Western Europe? No, that's not how governments talk to their allies. That's a domestic concern. Never mind the fact that Israel just went through an election. They don't have to have an election for a few years. Chuck Schumer is basically giving another veiled threat: is if you don't start playing ball, we want you to basically resign. I've never heard any, even among allies that disagree with each other, with different political parties in power, this kind of talk is pretty unprecedented. And later on in the speech, among other things, he was talking about Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gavir, two cabinet members from right-wing parties that Netanyahu's in, saying that because Netanyahu's dealing with these particular figures and the Israeli far right, and he's listening to them, and that's why Israel's going down this path, Israel is going to become a pariah, and it can't live like that. First off, as if Hamas could survive as a pariah. It's not fine for Israel to be a pariah, but Hamas, they want to let them live. Secondly, those two guys I mentioned, Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, they're not even part of the war council. One's the finance minister and one's the national security minister. They're not even part of the war council. They're the biggest parties in Netanyahu's coalition. There are smaller parties with more cabinet members than those parties. Netanyahu is trying to make sure they don't have as big of a say as maybe they would like to in the government. That's not enough. Never mind what the Israeli electorate picked. And never mind the fact that even if Netanyahu himself is getting unpopular for letting the October 7th massacre happen, most Israelis agree with his policies. Most Israelis at this point don't want a two-state solution. Yet, according to Chuck Schumer in his speech, that's the big reason why the Israeli government has to go.
Call me an optimist, but I believe that if the Israeli public is presented with a path to a two-state solution that offers a chance at lasting peace and coexistence, then most mainstream Israelis will moderate their views and support it.
There's Mr. Schumer again, and I think he made a pretty telling remark in there. It's not just, according to him, once a viable peace plan burst brought out, as if like the Palestinians have ever brought peace plans of their own. It's always Israel is giving peace plans, and they keep getting rejected. But once a peace plan comes up, then most mainstream Israelis would, in his words, moderate their opinions. In other words, what most mainstream Israelis are thinking of right now is not, in his eyes, moderate. So even if he's trying to get Netanyahu out of the way, deep down, he and all the Democrat intelligentsia, they know that Israel in general wants Hamas out of the way. They know they're not on ball. The Israeli people themselves are not on ball with this plan. Some of these other things he mentioned about, like, say, all these rising casualty figures, like 30,000 plus people. First off, media reports have shown that there are highly problematic issues with the numbers. Like, at one point, Tablet, which is a Jewish magazine, did a tally of Hamas's death toll early on in the war and showed a uniform increase, which is highly unrealistic if there was an actual war going on. Hamas has been known to lie, to fabricate their numbers and add hundreds of casualties before And they also don't count military death tolls. Israel claims that roughly 13,000 terrorist soldiers, whatever you want to call them, are among the casualties. That most media, when they report that, most politicians, when they talk about the casualties, they don't say that. They don't say that a lot of those people that died are legitimate targets, are combatants. The big thing that sort of caught my eye with this is Chuck Schumer knows this. And everybody in the Democratic apparatus, the Biden administration knows this. If a smaller magazine like Tablet can figure this out, don't tell me the CIA can't either. Don't tell me everybody on these committees can't figure it out either. They know what's going on in Gaza, and they know that the Israeli people support, in general, the war effort right now. This is not a humanitarian option to try and get a bad leader out of position. This is an active, I hate using this word, but it's really no better word to describe it. It's a conspiracy, really, an international conspiracy to push Benjamin Netanyahu out of the way, which the presidents of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have done before, and which the Democratic Party is trying to do today.
And you see that come out in the open with a speech on the floor of the Senate by Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader. That's a not so veiled threat for people who watch these things, for certainly the leaders. If he's bold enough to come out there and say that and kind of group Benjamin Netanyahu in with Hamas, basically, and use this siren song of humanitarianism and moderation and pursuit of vice is no virtue, and excess in pursuit of virtue is no vice, right? Moderation is not good by itself. Moderation is not a virtue of its own. And when you're saying, let's be moderate, do you remember what happened on October 7th? Does everybody remember that, right? And here's Benjamin Netanyahu, who probably because of the pressure has set as the goal, the entire goal of this entire war is to restore deterrence. Palestinians are talking more boldly about wiping Israel off the face of the earth than he's talking about after October 7th. He's saying, let's restore deterrence. Let's weaken Hamas. Let's get them out of, you know, the very moderate approach. And even that's not good enough.
You could tell that this is against Netanyahu specifically, even with, like, you just compare with in November in Ukraine, the president there, Volodymyr Zelensky, he canceled presidential elections. They were supposed to happen this month because the country is under martial law. Nobody said anything about that. Israel's not even supposed to have elections, and they're angry at Netanyahu for not having elections. This is a particular bias against the current government of Israel and, as I alluded to, the Jewish state itself. And I mentioned political pressure from the outside. It's not just people trying to pressure the Israeli government to a two-state solution right now. If you go back to October 7th and what was leading up to it, and you see how Iran, Hamas's paymaster, was behaving, and you see how America was behaving towards Iran and how they were propping up Iran and giving Iran a few signals, even, if you will, to get this to go ahead. You could see this whole war as one way or another, whether it's the actual attack or the international pressure on Israel after the attack, has basically been used by the Democratic administration, by the government in the United States, to go after Israel and to go after Benjamin Netanyahu. When the October 7th attack happened, we wrote an article called "The Real Power Behind Hamas." That's the real power behind Hamas. That was in our November-December Philadelphia Tribune print edition. It refers to a prophecy in the book of the second book of Kings, chapter 14, verses 26 and 27, which speaks of bitter affliction hitting Israel, and that there'd be no helper for Israel, and that if something didn't happen, the name of Israel will be blotted out from under heaven. You look at what's happening in Israel right now, whether it's on October 7th or how the whole world is ganging up there right now, that's what blotting out the name of Israel looks like. And that's not even the finality of their plan. That's them trying to put their plan into motion. The rest of the prophecy talks about how this isn't the end of the story and how God will intervene to save Israel and protect them. We have a lot of literature that talks about that as well. But for now, we're seeing a concentrated attack on Israel. And that article, "The Real Power Behind Hamas," can show you some more details on that.
Israel there in 2 Kings 14, referring not only to the state of Israel, not even principally to the state of Israel, but to the other nations related to the brother nations of the state of Israel. including the United States and Britain. You can learn about why those are brother nations, why a reference to Israel there in 2 Kings 14 applies to the United States in the United States and Britain Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That's the United States and Britain in Prophecy by the late Herbert W. Armstrong. Now let's go to another region and another war zone and another set of alliances that is shaping the future of our world, your world. That's Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, you've been watching Asia.
Yes, first of all, Russia's presidential election is now underway. The voting spans from today until Sunday to decide who Russia's next leader will be. And the suspense here is, of course, it's non-existent. This is a sham election, a pseudo election. Russian President Vladimir Putin murders any Russians who could actually threaten his leadership. He kills them, takes their life, as we saw with Alexei Navalny last month, or at the very least, he imprisons them. So this makes the election a grotesque farce. Only pre-approved candidates are allowed on the ballot. And even then, there's rigging and manipulation with the tallying. So Putin's victory is assured. He'll have six more years at least. And since Western nations have decided not to stand up to his wars, we can expect more death and destruction from Russia as Putin enters into his sixth real term as head of the nation. Another story here about the Chinese Communist Party being very upset that the Biden administration is poised to ban TikTok. TikTok is the wildly popular social media app, the world's most popular website, actually, which the Chinese Communist Party controls. And on Wednesday, China's foreign ministry said if America goes through with the plan to ban it, that'll be a, quote, act of bullying. So the Chinese leaders are, feigning a lot of righteous indignation over this, but they made no mention of the fact that inside of China, they ban Instagram, Facebook, X, Google, and too many other U.S. sites and platforms to even count. The Chinese leaders banned those things because they don't want the Chinese people being exposed to some of the ideas on them. Like, for example, the idea of the rule of law and democracy and the fact that China has murdered so many of its people in the Tiananmen Square massacre, etc. The Chinese leaders very well understand the power of information. That's why they impose the most rigid imaginable controls on what the people inside of China can access. And that's also why they have deployed TikTok as a weapon against America and other nations. It's well established that the Chinese Communist Party uses TikTok to make young Americans hate America and to make young Americans hate themselves and to hate their God-given sex and to make them love Hamas and love China and love Russia. TikTok's algorithms push all of that content with real force into the feeds of American users in order to manipulate them. And then China, of course, also uses TikTok to spy on users, and it could weaponize all of its troves of American data at any time. So I'm in favor of this ban. It's long overdue, and I'm not surprised that the Chinese Communist Party is pouting about it. They're having a real temper tantrum because, they might not be able to poison the minds of Americans with this weapon anymore. Poor CCP.
Not that I recommend heavy use of social media, but if you are on an alternative to TikTok, Twitter, now known as X, you can go to x.com/the_trumpet. That's our social media feed where you'll find a video about your big story for this week. We've recorded a video on this that's available there. But for those who haven't seen the video, give us the big story.
Sure, yeah. It is that Russia's Air Force is really roaring back to life in its war against Ukraine. So we hear a good bit in the Western media about Ukrainian innovations in this war. Ukraine's successes with drone attacks and using civilian satellites to improve their targeting systems. Those and many other notable innovations have enabled the Ukrainians to stay in the fight far longer than most anyone would have expected. But the Russians, though, have not just been snoozing while Ukraine has evolved and adapted. Russia has also been innovating. And in recent weeks, the Russians have started modifying the Fab 1500 dumb bombs turning them into far more effective glide bombs. So the Fab 1500, it's about a 3,000-pound bomb, and almost half of that weight is high explosives. So just a stunning amount of firepower. These things are nicknamed building destroyers because they leave a crater that's something like 50 feet across. And Russia has massive stockpiles of these carried over from the Soviet era, tens of thousands of them apparently. Now, these Fab 1500s, they were originally designed just to be dead dropped from airplanes. That means the planes that drop them have to get, you know, well within enemy range. It also means the bombs have not the greatest accuracy. But now, with this new innovation, the Russians have factories humming where technicians are taking the old Fab 1500s, adding new pop-out wings to them, and adding new guidance systems to them as well. So this effectively turns them into glide bombs, and it does so at a fraction of the cost that it would take to manufacture new glide bombs. And with this modification, Russian pilots can remain something like 30 miles from the targets they're striking, and the Russians say that these are now accurate to within about 15 feet. So this is a tremendously significant development. This is a huge part of what enabled Russia to conquer Avdiivka last month. At certain points in the battle for Avdiivka, Russia was firing over 100 of these per day at the Ukrainians. And it's an innovation that Ukraine would only be able to counter if they brought a functional air force online, an air force capable of striking Russian warplanes before they could fire these new glide bombs. So it's a major game changer for Russia, and not just for the Ukraine war. Since they have tens of thousands of these building destroyer bombs in inventory, this innovation has implications that go beyond Ukraine.
Now, that's a very, very, very significant development. So this is something that is going to reshape the battle space significantly. So we're looking here at probably the most significant transformation in Russian military power in the last 30 years, and it's now being applied to a hot war zone.
That was geostrategist Peter Zion there, just showing what a huge development this is, with implications extending even beyond Ukraine. And it's still, you know, it's still early days on this, but if Russia can modify enough of these Fab 1500s quickly enough, it could really tip the scales in the war very rapidly.
I would just think of the human cost of this. I mean, you've given us reports before about the enormous barrages of missile strikes that Russia has been conducting. And I think airstrikes as well was part of that record barrage that you reported 1 week. And then the next week you said, well, we've got a new record. These things, I think you said they're more than 1,000 pounds, these bombs.
About 3,100 pounds.
3,100, wow.
3,100, and about half of that is the actual high explosive.
Wow, okay. That's incredible. Maybe what I was seeing was just the explosive content there,
right,
of it. But you see Russia developing this know-how, but also this experience. You know, when you're looking back through history, even in the modern era, you're seeing the importance not just of inventing weapons, but inventing weapons and then actually using them. And Russia's gaining a lot of experience in real world situations on how to destroy people, how to destroy civilians, how to destroy enemy forces as well, obviously.
I think it's interesting that all these developments are coming in right about the same time we got, as we spoke about on this program before, we're getting revelations that there are British soldiers on the ground in Ukraine, that there are French soldiers on the ground in Ukraine. I haven't had a chance to look up to see if this is actually going to happen, but I remember hearing French President Emmanuel Macron recently saying that French defense companies will even start having factories produce weapons in Ukraine itself. This is no longer just Russia trying to gobble up one of its old satellite states. This is a proxy war between Russia and Western Europe. I don't think we're going to see actual soldiers fighting in the war, but the fact that you're seeing European soldiers, British soldiers in Ukraine, with Ukrainian soldiers using their weapons or whatever, this is giving Russia real-world battle experience on not just, like, again, a small, in their eyes, breakaway region, but against the heavy artillery of the West that they've been preparing to go to war for decades, which for longtime listeners of this program, we expect Russia to at least go to war with Europe at some point too. It's not just Europe waking up to the threat that we have an aggressive Russia at the door. We need to start changing our viewpoints and how we do things with our militaries. Russia, I think, more and more is starting to see the war with Western Europe. And these are not on the map. They don't look that big, some of these countries. France is not a small military power. Germany is not a small military power. Even Poland, as we talk about over and over again, that's all of a sudden turning into the new superpower of conventional arms. Russia has been invaded time and time again from countries like those throughout all its history. And certainly it has in the back of its mind that if this Ukraine war spirals out of control, we might need to get ready for actual more real world battles between actual equals in terms of firepower, in terms of population, in terms of that sort kind of thing. That may very well be a part of why these kinds of weapons are being developed.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about just how much Russia is learning, practicing, making a lot of mistakes, perhaps, but able to refine a lot of its techniques against some very advanced weaponry. It does remind me of an article we've got up on our website at the moment that I think is just a really critical one for understanding what's going on in Europe, called France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany. And it makes the point that France kind of does seem fairly keen on sending in trainers and fighting Russia here, but Germany is heading in a very different direction, and that it's not this united Western front against Russia. And there's I think it's a fascinating insight into this Franco-German relationship, the dynamic there where Macron is trying to drag Germany in a direction that they just will not go. You know, you can watch this and see who's really in charge of Europe, that it's Germany that's going to ultimately set the direction here and decide what they want. And so I think, you know, Germany is quite happy to fly under the radar to a certain extent. They don't want to make very public that they have a fundamental disagreement with the rest of NATO or with France or with the United States when it comes to Ukraine. But they are certainly doing a lot to stop this from being maybe a full-blown proxy war of NATO versus Russia and Ukraine, and to do what they can to limit the modern weapons that are heading there.
Yeah, I think those are some excellent points. And just getting back to this this innovation that the Russians are spearheading here, it does look like it could be a fairly significant game changer. And I think this shows that Putin remains utterly unwavering, unyielding in his goal of conquering Ukraine. Ukraine wanted to lean toward Europe and not so much toward Russia, and he would not allow that. And so he has waged this war that's killing so many people. And this new innovation by the Russians suggests that the scales are tipping more into Russia's favor. And one thing that we can know for sure is that whatever may happen in the war tomorrow or this week or this month, Bible prophecy assures us that Putin will come out of it politically unbroken and actually even mightier. The scriptures show that he personally will play a role in some larger wars in the future. And we have an article all about these prophecies. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches a Russian Strongman Dominating Asia.
So Fab 1500 bombs being turned into glide bombs, part of this war experience that we're talking about Russia gaining, but also Putin unwavering, Putin demonstrating complete control of an election, Putin demonstrating control of the population, getting enough support from the population to continue a destructive war. That's also war experience, right? That's also demonstrating and learning how to prosecute a war, who to fire, what generals to send into the front lines and to their end. All of those types of things are teaching this man to war in the real world in a big, big way against a modern enemy that does have a lot of support from NATO, not a united support from NATO like we've talked about. But what is Vladimir Putin turning into in this process is my point. You'll learn more about that and why the Trumpet Watches a Russian strongman dominating Asia, as Jeremiah mentioned there. And also that article Mr. Palmer mentioned, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany, which is on the front page of thetrumpet.com right now. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review on KPCG. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to Trumpet Hour Week in Review here on March 15th, Friday. We give you the events of the week from the four main regions, Asia, the Middle East, Anglo-America, and Europe. Next up is Europe. Richard Palmer watches Europe and lives just across the way from it and has some thoughts about the main stories that have developed this week.
European arms imports are up. We've seen several news stories around Europe arming itself. Rheinmetall, this big German defense conglomerate, held an earnings call on Wednesday where executives there said they expected to exceed 10 billion euros in sales for the first time ever. Profit margins are up. Share price is up 50% compared to the same time last year. The Stockholm Institute, International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, they publish annual data on arms trading. They showed how Europe's arms imports have doubled. And the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists had a good article on why Germany's nuclear debate is different this time. We've talked about it on the show. You may have heard about it, though. You know, it crops up every few years while they have this debate. Is what's going on now different? Is it the same old debate that's going round and round and round? They look into that and say, well, you know, this time it's powerful politicians, not simply pundits, talking about Germany getting nuclear weapons, and you've got the public much more willing to get involved. Also, Germany's getting more involved in Gaza. They are airlifting in supplies for the Palestinians, or airdropping them in the similar way to the United States. Cyprus is emerging as a key logistics hub for European efforts to get resources in there. So we're seeing Europe kind of playing an increasing role in the Middle East, and especially in that Palestinian conflict, perhaps setting them up to play a kind of the peacekeeping role, in quotes, that we're expecting them to play as they take on a greater role in the Middle East. Israel's also talking about setting up a kind of backup port within Cyprus. So it's fascinating to see Cyprus playing a, you know, as the focus, as the world's focus turns to Israel, Cyprus becomes this really important piece of real estate. And that is something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has just been locked onto for several years. He drew attention to Cyprus right at the start of what was happening with October 7th. And so I think that's something that is important to watch. And relating to what we were just talking about, the Pope says that Ukraine needs the courage to raise the white flag. He did try to clarify that kind of later, saying, well, he meant the white flag to negotiate. Maybe raising the white flag has different connotations in Argentina. I guess it certainly does in France. But just like Germany, the Catholic Church appears to be kind of taking the Russian side, or at least leaning Russian. And that raises the question of, have they done a deal with Russia? So that's a rundown of quite a lot of material. You can get more details, of course, on all of that on thetrumpet.com.
Mr. Palmer is a Briton, in case you were wondering, hence the white flag dig there at France. Cyprus emerging as an important geopolitical chess piece has been really interesting. Like you said, Mr. Fleury went straight to Cyprus when all of us were just still basically in shock at October 7th and Hamas. And he wrote about that, talked about that. But he immediately emphasized the importance of Cyprus and Europe and Germany's deployments there. Interesting that Israel obviously also sees its significance. It's a 45-minute flight from Israel to Cyprus, a little longer by boat. But you see that that island is becoming important, and Israel would like to make use of it, but so would a much bigger power waiting in the wings. What's the main story out of Europe that you'd have us focus on?
So, yes, French, we love you. But I do have to get in the occasional little digs every now and again. But you know who else we love in Britain? The Portuguese. Portugal is our oldest ally. And the main story this week revolves around Portugal, where they've succumbed to Europe's political disease, where they held a general election on Sunday. And in this election, it's the same story that you see across a lot of other European countries. You have a fringe right party in Portugal. It got started in 2019, so very new. It's called Chega, and it saw its share of the vote rise from 7.4% at the last election to 18%. It's gone from having 12 seats in the 230-strong parliament to 48. And this has put a major spanner in the works for Portugal's parliamentary system. It used to be the very simple, easy to understand type of system. You have a main left-wing party, you have a main right-wing party. Portugal's not one of these countries where you have the big unwieldy coalitions and all of that. It's much more straightforward, typically. Now, though, the Alliance for Democracy, that's the main right-wing party, you know, the Portuguese Republicans, you could say, they only got 30% of the vote. They don't have enough to form a government by themselves. The only way they can form a government, well, there's a couple of ways. They could form a government by doing a deal with Chega, but they said they would not do that during the election campaign because they knew that would alienate voters if they said they'd work with the fringe right. Alternatively, then they could do a deal with the Portuguese Democrats, the Socialist Party, the main left-wing party. But the Democrats, the Socialists, ruled that out during the election campaign as well. So somebody's got to break their word if Portugal's going to get a government. That's never good for the health of democracy. I imagine maybe they'll find some kind of technically kind of small print of, well, technically we promised we wouldn't go in a coalition, but we'll support a minority government or something like that. But you've got them in this sticky situation. And it's the same sticky situation we see everywhere. You know, one of the recent countries we were talking about this that was in this sticky situation is the Netherlands. And we had some more news out of the Netherlands this weekend where Geert Wilders officially gave up on becoming prime minister, where he's this fringe right group that actually came in first place. They've had kind of several cycles of this, but they've spent months trying to get together a government and they're still struggling. And it looks like they're going to have some kind of technocratic government. So all across Europe, you've got this spread of this kind of political paralysis as these fringe parties rise up. And then it means that no mainstream coalition from just one side of the electorate can get a majority. And you have paralysis, you have awkward, unwieldy governments that everybody hates. And it's something that, you know, I'm calling it a disease because it does kind of corrupt the very function of democracy and makes people even question, not just I don't like these people and I don't like this party, but is my system working properly? Is my constitution working properly? Is even democracy that great of an idea if it's leading to paralysis that's lasting years in country after country?
Right. I was about to ask you to define that European disease, but you defined it just perfectly. Political paralysis. You say Portugal has succumbed to that disease. Can you rattle off just the other nations that you would say are in this same type of situation?
So Sweden, you've got a similar situation where you've got a fringe right, often called far right party, that's propping up the government in a minority relationship. Germany, it's not clear how you could ever have a stable coalition again. When you look at the current polling there, and this government is one of the most unpopular in history. Spain, you have Catalan separatists, so it's a little bit different, but still a party that's kind of outside of the norm, constantly gumming up the works there, and they've got a pretty unstable government. You've got pretty right-wing figures in charge, people like Robert Fico or Viktor Orban in Eastern Europe, where they've kind of the mainstream has shifted into that right-wing position. In Ireland, you've got Sinn Féin, a radical, basically terrorist-supporting or terrorist group themselves, part of the government or supporting the government. So that's a radical left party that's doing very well there. France, you're heading into European elections across all of Europe, but people are especially looking at France here, where you've got formerly the National Front. There, I think it's as accurate to call them far left as it is far right. But there's even a chance that they could take the presidency when it's next up. So it's spreading around a lot of different European countries.
I fully agree with you about the, you know, the significance of this trend, these right-leaning fringe parties rising up, and democracy across Europe seems to be just faltering and foundering. I wonder if you have any insights into what specific factors are causing more Europeans to shift right. Is this, you know, is this a reaction to immigrants pouring in and undermining Europe under sort of these left-leaning policies that came before? Is this fear of Donald Trump returning and breaking more ties with Europe? Or are there other drivers of this shift?
I've called this a death spiral before because I think it is. Once it gets started, just even to a small extent, it feeds on itself and gets worse and worse and worse. So I think what's at the fundamental of a lot of this is that the mainstream, you know, the elites, the deep state, kind of however you want to label them, have tried to lock in their opinions as to how Europe should be run, how countries in general should be run. And they've tried to cement those into basically constitutional law. So in their, and they have a fairly narrow range of acceptable opinions they believe people should be allowed to agree or disagree within. And anything outside of that, they've done a good job of pushing it outside the system. So migration generally should be allowed. And fundamentally under EU law, you make it to Europe, you can stay in Europe. That's basically what it is there. Things like climate change, EU law has been reinterpreted to mean that governments must take action against climate change, quote unquote, that they must do things that quite obviously harm their economies, you know, like shutting down your farming industry, that it's cemented there in laws that were signed in many cases decades ago that no one at the time would have ever said had anything to do with this, but they've been reinterpreted. Yeah, I think there's other things like that. And yeah, you know, migration, we mentioned. Some of these things, though, then if you want to overturn it, you're kind of automatically outside the system. You're outside of the mainstream media. You can't write in mainstream press. You're outside of mainstream politics because the mainstream parties ostracize you. So anyone that has reasonable disagreements with these policies is forced to go to anti-system parties. So I think this kind of leads to the rise of these anti-system, smash-the-system parties. Once you get enough people go to these anti-system parties, the only stable coalitions become left-right coalitions. That's what we've seen in Germany now going on for close to a couple of decades. And these tend to do nothing, accomplish nothing. So this makes more people believe the system is broken. It pushes more people to anti-system parties, and it gets worse and worse and worse. So I think that is a big part of it. And I think there's kind of twin dangers here in Europe. You've got some of these fringe groups. I have a lot of respect for Geert Wilders. You know, some of these fringe groups I think are kind of great, or I kind of have some admiration for the courageous guys that lead them. Some of them, like the Alternative for Deutschland, and there's some in other countries, you know, Sinn Féin in Ireland, they're actively dangerous. And you look at what the AfD do, and they genuinely have a lot of people in there that glorify Hitler and think that Hitler's a great guy and he's misunderstood. Like, that is a reasonably mainstream position within the Alternative for Deutschland. So there's a danger in the rise of these parties. There's also a danger in the way that Europe is confronting these parties. So there was a big story this week in Germany that's done the rounds in social media, where some 16-year-old girl in Germany shared a meme about the Smurfs. Do you have the Smurfs in America? Do people know the Smurfs?
Yes.
Like, they're these blue cartoon characters with white hats. And yeah, so she shares some kind of meme from the Smurfs about we love our homeland. And it ends up with her being hauled out of her chemistry class by three police officers because the meme is interpreted as being supportive of the AfD. Like, you start cracking down on what people, much as I think the AfD is dangerous, in many ways, that's more dangerous. Like, you start hauling 16-year-old girls out of their, having police haul her out of their class because she said something, you know, for a thought crime, you're going to send more people to the AfD. You're also creating something genuinely dangerous. Like, so you're just seeing democracy break down in multiple ways across Europe.
Right. And describing it as paralysis is a really good way to do it. And I remember you, I think, writing about it when you were a college student. And I was trying to look back and see, you know, I looked for the term fringe because we started using that term, these fringe parties. And my best assessment is it was about 10 years ago that we started writing about it more consistently. And Europe has been in an ongoing paralysis, and not just Europe, but you can see, like, how can we not solve these clear problems? Immigration is clearly a problem. You know, what illegal immigrants are doing in situation after situation is clearly a problem. A government has a basic, you know, responsibility to do these few basic things, and the government is not doing it. And as you said, in some cases, it passed laws, especially supranational laws in Europe, where you basically can't do either one. You can't solve the problem without breaking the law, and you can't do much of anything. And they've kind of painted themselves into a corner. And the point being, as you're saying, this does open up the possibility for Europe to be interested in something drastically different than, you know, pseudo-American style or British style, I should say, democracy, and look for some other kind of strong leader.
And maybe this is the difference between Europe and the United States, and part of it. You know, take immigration. America doesn't have anything in the Constitution saying you've got to have wide open borders, or when people arrive here, you can't deport them, or anything. Like, they've not adopted the European Convention of Human Rights and things like that. So you could have another party come to power in the United States and they can change course. And for Europe, the way that the European Convention on Human Rights has been now embedded into constitutional law for most European countries and international law, and like, that can't really happen. If you have to rebuild, you have to tear down the foundations of that government. I mean, countries can change constitutions peacefully. I mean, that has happened in France, it's happened in the United States, but that's a much bigger, more traumatic issue. And so you can see how in Europe there is a different dynamic generally, and then you've got this different setup there. And it is going to lead to and playing a major part in a transformation in Europe. And this is what we have been watching for, is the rise of strongman type leadership in Europe. And so when we're watching the rise of these fringe groups, we're not necessarily saying these fringe groups are going to take over and become the strongmen. They may. I think you look at, say, Italy, and I think that pretty much does describe what's happened in Italy. But also when you look at authorities taking teenage girls out of chemistry class with the police, you know, there's also perhaps the mainstream becoming authoritarian in response to these groups. But either way, you're looking at the end of liberalism, you know, free speech and freedom of thought and religion, and the end of democracy, and Europe going with a fundamentally different system. And the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong, or that Herbert W. Armstrong, really trumpeted to the world for decades, you know, talk about a Europe led by kings, you know, led by not presidents, not elected heads of state, led by, at least to a certain extent, autocratic dictators. And it's a Europe that imposes its own views of religion on those that live there, has limits on freedom of speech. That's what the Bible says that is coming in Revelation 13 and in Revelation 17 that discuss this rising beast or empire that is coming. So that's where the Bible says we're heading. And you can see how the trends of today are pushing Europe, and Europe is moving in that direction already. And, you know, I said trends of today, we have our trends section on the website that does exactly that, that connects the trends of today. And then we really, in those articles, try to give a very simple and concise as we can, but complete breakdown of why the Bible says we're heading in this way. And kind of from first principles, not assuming any knowledge. And we want you, you know, we want you to be able to go there and understand these trends for yourself. I think I've just been talking to some of our listeners and readers recently, and I think for some, there's a tendency where they want to outsource their understanding of the Bible to someone else. And okay, well, that's what my church or this group does for me. You know, I'm here to tell you that's not what the Bible tells you to do. You need to prove and understand these things for yourself, and not just take my word for it, not take our word for it when we say, well, the Bible says this is going to happen, because you can go and find a whole lot of people out there who say something very different. You need to dig into the Bible and prove that for yourself. And we really designed these trends articles to try and help you do that. And so we have one of those trends articles, Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a German Strongman, that just tries to basically explain why we're expecting this whole character of Europe to change.
That was thetrumpet.com/trends. Go there, prove it for yourself, indeed for yourself. Open up your own Bible and have a look and prove for yourself whether that is what the Bible means, whether that does describe what you're seeing on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and Sky News, and what you're seeing unfold around you, because things are unfolding and understanding is at a premium. You know, if you're just looking at this world, it's very hard to understand what's happening and why it's happening. Thetrumpet.com/trends, a good place to start. But as Mr. Palmer said there, prove it for yourself. Our fourth region is Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, you've been watching the United States and the other brother nations we talked about earlier in the show. What's been happening in Anglo-America?
Yeah, a lot of big news this week as the primaries continue here in the United States political scene. Donald Trump got enough delegates this week to officially clinch the Republican nomination for president, and Joe Biden did the exact same thing for the Democratic Party. So barring any major unexpected upsets, we're heading into a show-off between Trump and Biden again later this year. As Mihailo mentioned, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and called for fresh elections in Israel in a pretty unprecedented act of political interference in another nation's electoral
regime
system.
Change light.
And then just showing how the social educational side of things are going, a private university in Virginia announced that its students will soon be able to major in cannabis studies. So I was tempted to make a joke about putting the high in higher education, but it is actually a pretty good reflection of just kind of like higher education in the United States this year. Just like over, I mean, this is kind of an extreme example, but like the idea that like this woke agenda has just really taking people's minds in just weird directions and giving like what type of job, what type of employer are you going to sit down to an interview and you say like, oh, I majored in weed,
right,
and expect to contribute anything to this company.
Right. What's the main story from Anglo America?
The main story is actually a pretty shocking video that came out this week from the O'Keefe Media Group. Actually, for those who don't know, James O'Keefe is the head of the O'Keefe Media Group. A controversial figure, let's say the least, in American journalism. He does undercover interviews, which are illegal in many states. Actually records people without their knowledge and puts himself in situations where he tries to get them to like open up and say how they really feel about things that they wouldn't normally say on camera. And it's a 20-minute interview. You can find it online if you want to. I've opted not to include any clips this week or put it in the show notes just for the sake that is like, just want our listeners to know that the Trumpet doesn't necessarily endorse undercover video recordings. And if you do see this particular video, James O'Keefe, he's actually posing as a homosexual on a date with this guy to get him to lower his guard. So there are definitely elements of the video I wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable advertising on our website. But that aside, I did debate over whether to bring this up at all, but some of the information that just is out there now is so shocking. I felt we should comment on it because this man O'Keefe's interviewing, it's Jason Beck. He is an assistant director in the office of Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. So right there in the office of the man who's running American defense. And so his views are a reflection on his office and on the man that Joe Biden, or really Barack Obama, has chosen to run American defense. And then this interview, Jason Beck, he outright says that we need to abolish the Second Amendment that guarantees Americans the right to bear arms. After that's done, he said you need to confiscate all the guns. And he's talking about, he actually said, O'Keefe asked him, like, how would you do that? He's like, well, we need to mobilize the National Guard to go house to house and take people's weapons away. Then later he brings up, like, he said, well, what if the law doesn't like support that? He's like, said, well, we really just need to abolish the Senate and have a one-cameral legislature, pack the Supreme Court with radical justices that will uphold whatever that legislature decides, tear down the border wall. He specifically said that there's no immigration crisis. There's a humanitarian crisis on the border, but there's, with a lot of people being trafficked and abused and things like that. But he said, there's no security crisis. There's no Taliban coming into America, even though we have video footage of terrorists coming into America. And so that's quite the assessment. I mean, you're basically looking at like a communist style dictatorship where the no one's armed. There's no constitutional provision to be armed. The Supreme Court just rubber stamps whatever your unicameral legislature decides, and you just have whatever third world immigrant who wants to come here be able to come here, and just people have no recourse away from this. And like I said, this particular man, he also said that he's going through like a transgender surgery, so anyone who's cutting off parts of their own body is not mentally well and should not be working as an assistant director for the Secretary of Defense for the strongest military on planet Earth. this interview with Jason Bex really shows you like what's wrong with American defense. I actually wrote an article we'll put in the show notes over a year ago titled "A Woke Military Endangers Us All." And this interview definitely shows why a woke military endangers us all.
Did you see the article that perhaps connects both of your stories?
Perhaps not.
Well, but yeah, a small story that shows higher education going down the drain and change in values in the United States military. West Point is getting rid of duty, honor, and country. Yes. I mean, I think it's exactly the same thing that you're saying, that it's the values that they used to cherish, they decided they're editing that out of their mission statement. They're no longer wanting to train graduates that are committed to the values of duty, honor, and country, because then you're going to have more people like the guy that you describe graduating West Point and being at the top of the U.S. military.
Exactly. And they're replacing it with something to the effect of Army values, something like a committed to Army values, which means next to nothing, since a value can be negative, positive, mathematically. We avoid the word virtue and we use the word value. I've got a vendetta against the word value, but we'll leave that for another day. But I had written down that same word connects, because it's interesting to me that these things are connected in this man's mind. This federal defense official, as you said, is a type of personal character that is not fit for duty. But he is linking destroy the Constitution, destroy the legislature, destroy the judicial branch. So what do you have left? You have an enormous executive branch to do, you know, whatever it wills. The will of the people is not expressed through the legislature. And you have blotted out the constitutional republic at that point. If this man, who is a fairly powerful man, gets what he wants. Of course, it's just talk, but it does give you an insight into how they think.
Right. And the prophecy that comes to mind and that I've put in the show notes is Isaiah 3 verses 1 through 3, which is about a curses God sends on end time Israel, specifically just taking away its leadership. It says, "For behold, the Eternal, the Lord of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the man of war." And then also like the eloquent and the prudent and the cunning orator. So taking away leadership in many sectors of society, but particularly the man of war. And so now you've got a transgender man who hates the Constitution and wants an open border and gun confiscation working in the office of the defense secretary. He's definitely not a man of war. And Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, is not a man of war either. And it definitely shows that this is kind of like the first domino to fall. Like, I mean, you've got other prophecies about military invasion and captivity and slavery. And it really just gets down to the fact that despite the fact that America spends more on its military than the next 10 militaries on the earth combined, and they use that money to open the border and start taking guns away from American citizens. But it's like this type of logic says, like, all the money in the world's not going to defend you if you don't actually have any leadership in your military.
That's right. I think that's an excellent thing to point to, as well as you might have mentioned that article that you provided to me in the notes, "A Woke Military Endangers Us All." And it is interesting. What is it that connects all those things? You know, in this one story, you have transgenderism, homosexuality, destruction of the Constitution, opening the border, abolishing the legislature, abolishing the judiciary. Why is America doing this to itself? You know, why is it doing these things? It's not an awakening. It's something else. And so I would also recommend America Under Attack. There's got to be some kind of connection. Something that's, first of all, powerful enough to cause all these things, and something that's motivated to move them in the direction they're going. Mr. Palmer talked about a political sickness. This is a moral sickness. This is a mental sickness that many in America and the West have. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour this week. We appreciate our panel, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, Andrew Miller, and Jeremiah Jacques, bringing us those updates. We appreciate you listening. We invite you to write us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks for listening to the Wednesday shows. Our replays of older shows have been playing on Wednesdays. We appreciate your comments on those as well. Again, letters@thetrumpet.com. And thank you again for listening to The Week in Review. We look forward to being back with you on Trumpet Hour.